Hello, I'm Hazem Sika. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, Liz Truss is gone, leaving the UK in political and economic turmoil. Can a new prime minister steady the ship? Also this week, turning the taps back on, Russia offers to supply gas to Europe again, but European leaders aren't biting. And a historic gas deal between Lebanon and Israel. Could supplies in the Eastern Mediterranean ease Europe's energy crunch? Well, Liz Truss's term was marred by economic policies that roiled financial markets and sparked rebellion in her own party. The prime minister is now out after her finance minister scrapped pretty much all of her free market agenda. But Truss's departure has plunged the UK into yet another period of economic uncertainty. And many British people are asking whether her replacement, the third this year, will be able to tame soaring inflation and kickstart economic growth.
We delivered on energy bills and on cutting national insurance. And we set out a vision for a low-tax, high-growth economy that would take advantage of the freedoms of Brexit. I recognise, though, given the situation, I cannot deliver the mandate on which I was elected by the Conservative Party. I have therefore spoken to His Majesty the King to notify him that I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Well, the pound rose against the dollar and government borrowing costs dipped after the Prime Minister announced her resignation. Truss's low tax and low regulation policies sent investors fleeing and pushed the pound to an all-time low against the greenback at one point. Truss had tried to save her position by admitting her plan was a mistake and appointing Jeremy Hunt as a new finance minister. Hunt has reversed almost all of her tax cut and spending plans in an effort to restore the government's credibility. Among the measures Jeremy Hunt announced, scaling back the government's costly state intervention to cap energy prices, which will now end next April. Reduction of the basic income tax rate would also be shelved after plans to scrap the 45% rate of tax for top earners were previously dropped. A planned increase in corporate taxes will now go ahead after the government initially said it will cancel the rise. And Hunt says he was open to imposing a windfall profits tax on energy producers, a measure the government had previously rejected. Well, joining us now from London is Gregor Irwin, a chief economist at the Global Council. Thanks very much for being with us. So how is all of this political turmoil right now affecting the markets and the economy?
Well, we can see some very visible signs of how it's affecting the markets. Sterling has been under pressure for some time now, for several weeks. And in the financial markets, the cost of borrowing for the UK government has gone up, and it's gone up quite significantly, and it's been volatile.
And how profound is the economic damage caused by Liz Truss's original tax plans and then the decision to reverse all of that?
Well, I think it certainly damaged the credibility of the UK government. Financial markets in difficult circumstances always want to know that governments have a credible fiscal strategy. That's been absent for some time in the UK. And the priority right now is to re-establish credibility with financial markets by making sure that that fiscal strategy is clear and that the UK government is bound by a sensible set of fiscal rules. If that doesn't happen, then, of course, it is damaging that the higher interest rates that the government is having to pay now on its borrowing, that's being reflected in the cost of borrowing for households and firms and mortgages. Mortgage rates are going up. That will impact on the cost of living for many households, and businesses will also come under pressure. They rely on credit, and credit's becoming more expensive in the UK.
But the backtracking on the original tax cut plans does seem to have steadied the ship for now, doesn't it? And do you see the potential for this Conservative government to eventually fix the economy?
The backtracking has steadied the ship to quite a significant extent, there's still a part of the job that needs to be done, which is the Chancellor has now to set out spending plans for the next year and possibly further ahead in the light of the changed economic circumstances, and also needs to set out new fiscal rules and explain how everything adds up so that the government will meet those fiscal rules. So the job is partly done. It's not completed yet. And I think whether it's this government or a new government or the next Labour government after an election that does that, I think one thing that will happen is the political discussion around fiscal policy will change in the UK as a result of this whole episode. The days of just ignoring the trade-offs that are always required in fiscal policy, I think, are gone. It doesn't mean austerity, but it does mean that the numbers have to add up in future. And just one other thing I would emphasise, I think if Liz Truss's government has done one thing, they put growth back on the agenda, and I think that will probably be around with us as a focus for policy discussions for some time to come.
From income tax to energy bills, as well as budget cuts, how is all of this going to affect the British people? I mean, are we looking at another era of austerity here?
It's definitely already impacting on household budgets. Just a couple of days ago, we had the latest inflation figures, inflation creeping above 10%, food price inflation creeping above 14%. So the poorest households are hit the hardest. And of course, we know that energy prices are also rising rapidly. Add on top of that the cost of borrowing, mortgage rates going up, then yes, household finances are under pressure and that will impact on the economy. Are we going to face another age of austerity? I think that's, I don't think we can say that just yet. I think the key thing for UK governments now after this whole episode is to keep in mind that whether you're a high tax government or a low tax government, the numbers have to add up. So you can't just borrow indefinitely in large quantities. You need to have a credible fiscal strategy that you present to financial markets if you're not to have the sort of rebound that we've seen in financial markets with the cost of borrowing spiking as it has done.
So can the government fill the fiscal hole and eventually deal with this tax, with this deficit?
Yes, it can, and it's already made some progress by reversing most of the tax changes that were originally announced by the former Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng. Now, that will take us some way to filling the gap, but there's almost certainly more that needs to be done. Spending will come under pressure. And actually, I think what financial markets want to see is that the gap is not just filled now in this financial year and the next financial year. They want to have a sense that actually there's a coherent fiscal policy in place in future years as well. That doesn't necessarily mean austerity, though. It means that you need to match your spending ambitions to your tax policies. And that was the mistake, or one of the many mistakes made by the Truss government.
Gregor Irwin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Europe has been busy lining up alternative gas supplies in an effort to reduce its reliance on Russian energy. It's cutting demand and preparing for a complete halt to Russian gas. But despite its efforts, things are likely to get worse next year. And Russian President Vladimir Putin has offered to resume deliveries through the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Germany immediately rejected the offer. Berlin halted the approval of Nord Stream 2 after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Moscow has stopped gas deliveries to Europe through the Nord Stream 1 pipeline, citing technical problems. The pipelines have been leaking gas into the Baltic Sea after explosions ruptured the lines in September. Europe suspects an act of sabotage, while Putin blamed the attacks on those who, quote, benefit in the West, hinting to U.S. involvement. Washington denies the allegations. The president says it was possible to repair the pipelines if their future use were guaranteed, and he is offering to reroute deliveries.
В регион Черного моря и сделать таким образом We could move the volume of transit lost along the Nord Streams, along the bottom of the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea region, and make the main routes for the supply of our fuel, our natural gas, to Europe through Turkey, creating in Turkey the largest gas hub for Europe, if, of course, our partners are interested in this.
Well, joining us from Oxford is Mike Fullwood, a senior research fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. Thanks for being with us. So what's Putin trying to do here? What's behind this decision to offer gas supplies again to Europe?
Yeah, well, I think it's, thank you for having me on. I think it's more a sort of vague offer to utilise the one remaining stream of Nord Stream 2, which has not been damaged. So there's gas in there and could be turned on at very short notice. That's not really going to happen because the Europeans aren't, obviously no longer trust Putin and Russia. And they're not going to allow Nord Stream 2 to flow. Obviously, you're going to have to wait until Nord Stream 1, the two legs there are fixed. I think the it's not like the, I think Alexei Miller, the head of Gazprom, said it would take years to fix. This could be fixed in a relatively short timescale. I mean, 6 to 8 months, if you can get the equipment there and inspect what needs to be done. But it shouldn't take that long. But I think the geopolitics sort of may well get in the way of that. But we don't really see any more Russian gas coming to the EU or to Europe. The danger is, of course, with more bombing on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, that Ukraine flows may get cut off.
As you say, there are clearly trust issues here. Germany has already refused the offer, but it leaves the question of whether Europe has enough gas to survive without Russia's supplies.
Yeah, in terms of this coming winter, I think there's two timescales here. What might happen this coming winter? I mean, there's been a rapid fall in Russian gas, but that's been with European demand falling dramatically, partly because of milder weather, but also because of the industrial demand falling sharply. And with all the LNG coming in, because of increased supply and lack of demand in China particularly, then we've actually been able to fill storage to very high levels. So getting through this winter with a couple of caveats. One, it's a mild winter. And secondly, there's no real big surge back to the Asian markets, China, which it doesn't look like it's going to be. Then you'd probably just about get through this winter, but storage could end up being at relatively low levels as we enter the refill period. And the problem then is the lack of Russian gas means it's very difficult to fill storage, even to sort of 55-60% of capacity. So next winter could be a dire situation with low Russia flows. Certainly if Ukraine's cut off, it would get even worse.
So no return to Russian gas at all through the Nord Stream pipelines, but can Europe replace all Russian gas supplies?
Not in the what you might call the short to medium term. The reliance really is waiting for the more LNG supply to come on. Well, next year there should be a little bit of a fairly strong supply with sort of turnarounds in places like Freeport, the terminal in the US, which has been down. Full year from Norway, other US terminals, a bit more feed gas into certain areas. Next year's supply looks okay. But, Asian demand will like to rebound a little bit. But 24 and early 25, there's not much more supply coming on. It's not until we get into late 2025, 2026, when this next huge wave of LNG supply is expected to come on. I mean, by 2028, the amount of supply could increase by 45-50%. At that point in time, then, providing we've built the necessary infrastructure in Europe of regas terminals and pipeline connections to move the gas around, then we may return to, I say, some degree of normality in terms of the sort of rebalancing the market. But this is 3 to 4 to maybe 5 years away.
But Putin is suggesting Turkey as a gas hub. What are the challenges to that? And is Europe ready to buy gas from a project like this?
Well, it's not really. It's geopolitics with Erdogan and Putin. This is not really going to happen. I mean, there's sort of talks about more gas being maybe piped to Turkey, either to be traded there and sent into the Europe, but it's still Russian gas, and the EU is in no mood to buy more Russian gas. Or even more bizarrely, possibly liquefying the gas in Turkey and then shipping it by LNG. And that's an even more bizarre economic idea. This is not really a runner at all. I think it suits the politics of Putin and Erdogan to talk about it. It's not going to happen.
But alternative supplies seem to be a lot more costly at this point. The French president demanding the US and Norway sell at lower gas prices. What do you make of that?
It's just politics. I mean, it's all kind of linked up with the idea of capping the price of TTS. You know, sort of shooting the messenger, really. But the problem is, if Norway or the US, for example, sold it lower than the market price, I mean, then somebody else just makes the margin out of it and can resell it at the market price. Given the nature of the European market, the very liquid trading market, huge amounts of trades going on between various parties, it would just mean Norway not capturing the economic rent. Somebody else would capture the economic rent. So, it's really a non-starter.
Mike, for the moment, thank you, but stay with us. We will come back to you a little bit later in the program.
Okay.
Lebanon and Israel have reached an historic agreement on a disputed maritime border. The countries are technically at war and have no diplomatic relations, but they've managed to agree on how to share gas fields lying off their coasts. If ratified by both governments, the U.S. brokered accord could lead to both nations ramping up offshore gas production and to Israel exporting supplies to Europe. Israel is expected to produce natural gas from the Karish Maritime Reservoir, together with the Tanin field, is estimated to hold as much as 3 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. While Lebanon, which is in a deep economic crisis, hopes the neighboring Qana field could provide the country a financial lifeline worth billions of dollars. But the production is likely years away. Significant quantities of natural gas have been discovered in the eastern Mediterranean in recent years. The EU says the region can help wean the bloc off Russian energy. The bloc signed a trilateral gas agreement with Israel and Egypt in June. It enables Israel to increase the export of its natural gas to Egyptian ports, where it can be liquefied, then transported to Europe. Several other nations are also looking to boost gas supplies to European markets, but Greece and Turkey are locked in a dispute over seabed territories believed to contain lucrative gas deposits. And the divided island of Cyprus is yet to begin drilling in 3 major gas fields. The internationally recognized Greek Cypriot government and the Turkish-controlled northern Cyprus can't agree on how to divide the resources. Well, back now to Mike Forward, senior research fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. So, Mike, how significant is this Israel-Lebanon deal for both countries? And how much of a part did Europe's gas supply problems play in that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a dispute really sort of about the maritime border as to where you sort of draw a line out into the sea to decide which part of the Mediterranean Sea has control over the resources either side of it. So they now come to some sort of agreement on effectively what sort of belongs to Lebanon, what sort of belongs to Israel. I think the deal's on the sort of the Qana gas field, which is now wholly within the Lebanon area, but Israel may well have some sort of rights, at least some revenues from it, sort of on a sharing basis. I think it's obviously, given the security situation in Lebanon and obviously around the region, it may be quite difficult. But it possibly means the Qana gas field could get developed. I think Lebanon itself needs some gas, some energy for its own electricity system. There's also the possibility of, obviously, of exporting it, but that's where it kind of becomes tricky, because there are quite a few fields in that region which are being developed or could be developed to either become LNG or possibly less likely pipeline gas to Europe.
And can these fields fill a supply shortage gap in Europe then?
It's certainly not going to be in the short term. I think they're probably on as what we were obviously discussing earlier in terms of Russian gas and LNG. It will take quite a while to develop these fields. So you're talking about maybe 3, 4, 5 years before they would sort of hit the market. And it's not sure in what form they would hit the market. What's happening at the moment, of course, is Israel is sort of selling gas into Egypt, where it's been liquefied and exported there. And obviously there's the Cyprus field, Aphrodite, and other fields in the area. That East Med is quite prolific in terms of its potential. But how you actually evacuate that gas to the market, it looks like LNG is possibly the preferred option, which gives you flexibility to where it can go. Pipeline gas to Europe has all sorts of problems in terms of construction, and also the geopolitical problems of how do you deal with the Greek-Turkish issues on Cyprus.
Yeah, you mentioned Cyprus there. And so if we expand this to talk about the whole Eastern Mediterranean region and the gas supplies there, is there enough to eventually allow Europe to wean itself off of Russian gas?
I think it would help. I think it possibly comes a little bit too late. I think Europe can sort of, to some extent, wean itself off Russian gas by just importing a lot more LNG and with some sort of normalisation of the market sort of 4 or 5 years out. But I guess every little helps in a sense of additional supply. And the fact that it is close to Europe would probably be helpful. I think there are a number of geopolitical issues just to sort out there, given the nature of the disputes and politics in the region.
So what will it take for Europe to make the full use of Eastern Mediterranean fields?
I think in terms of if it becomes LNG, I mean, you may need to build more liquefaction facilities to fully sort of develop the reserves. That could be floating LNG, which may be a little bit quicker than trying to build onshore LNG facilities. I don't think we'll see more onshore facilities being built in Egypt, but there is enough potential capacity in the Egyptian existing plants to take some of the gas in. But for full development, you may require a floating LNG option, which could be relatively quickly, but you need to develop the reserves and fields in parallel, or know that's going to happen before you bring the floating LNG facility in. So the advantage of LNG, of course, it doesn't necessarily need to go to Europe. It can also go elsewhere, so you have a lot more flexibility in sort of doing that. But it's helpful, but it's not the ultimate solution.
All right, good to get your perspective on all this. Mike Forward, thanks very much for being on Counting the Cost.
Thank you.
Qatar has launched its first solar power plant. It's expected to become the largest in the world, covering the equivalent of 1,400 football fields. Osama bin Javed reports.
Qatar wants to expand its renewable energy. As a step towards that, it's launched its first large-scale solar power plant, which is going to be generating 800 megawatts, about 10% of peak capacity here in Qatar. This is one of three power plants which are going to be coming up in the next few years. And the Minister for Energy says that they are on track to make sure that this country, which relies on its exports of hydrocarbons and usage of hydrocarbons, goes towards greener sources.
Solar is going to actually become more efficient and cheaper with time. And maybe the most important for us element is to try and reduce the size of land that you need. You know, Qatar has scarcity of land. It's a very small country. And you can see this is a giant project as far as land. This is the first project. The second project is already under construction, as I mentioned. 875 by Qatar Energy in our own industrial cities. That will take us to 1,600, and then we will see, with time, we will increase the rest.
The 1.8 million solar panels installed in this power plant are jointly operated by Total Energies, a Japanese firm, and a consortium of Qatari investors. The people behind it say that this is not just a PR exercise, but this clean energy will have a real impact on how people utilize energy.
Well, it's not just greenwashing, it's because we shifted our strategy. The ambition of Total Energies is to become a multi-energy company, which means oil, gas, and electricity from renewables. It's the first, I would say, world-scale plant that Total Energies has built. We have a great ambition to build 35 gigawatts by 2025. We have already built 16, and Air Doha in Qatar is 800 megawatts. So it's a strong contribution to our, I would say, roadmap and our ambition in renewables.
The Al Kharsa solar power plant goes online as the world grapples with an energy crisis, and Qatari authorities believe perhaps the world needs to move towards more cleaner and sustainable forms of energy.
And that is our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at Hazem Seeker, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, or drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. So that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Hazem Seeker from the whole team here. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.